Good to see you this morning. Can I just mention before we start this morning that Fergus Gordon, some of you all have known Fergus. I think he was baptized here in the church, and he died just this week. So our prayers are with the family. Just to mention this week we are continuing our series looking at an alternative Scottish church history, and some of you will know that during the summer, we didn't do it last year, maybe even not the year before, but I used to always take some time and reflect on aspects of Scottish church history and what we can learn from that. And so we're back doing that. I call it the tourist season. The reason is a lot of the congregation are away over the summer, so I don't want to preach my best sermons during that period. But I also want to do something meaningful, different, and interesting. And I know not everybody likes this, but quite a few people do, and they find it a little bit different. So that's why we do it through the month of July. And obviously, if you're a visitor, hopefully you'll learn a little bit about Scotland and some of our history. Now, when you begin to look at Scottish church history, it looks more like that passage from Amos than the one from Luke. It looks more like the desecration of the northern state of Israel than the story of the Good Samaritan. I really don't want to disavow you of that idea, because actually our church history is traumatic. One of the reasons I call this an alternative Scottish church history is because, well, partly you probably won't hear these ideas anywhere else, which maybe makes you suspect of them, probably should. But the other thing is that we sometimes have this incredibly romanticized idea of the past. This is particularly true of Scottish history. And it obviously helps with tourism, and it's a good thing. But we have these notions, particularly of Celtic saints, you know, wafting across the seas, bringing Christianity and love and peace to everybody. And you know, we kind of see our heritage. The truth is, our history is much more complex than that. And actually, as I say, it reads more like a passage from Amos than it does from the story of the Good Samaritan. This morning, I want to just start by considering this question. Why is Andrew the patron saint of Scotland? This is a fascinating question, because if you think about it, we have all these Celtic saints. We have St. Ninian, we have St. Columba, we have St. Mungo. You would anticipate that you would have a Celtic saint. You think about Wales, it's St. David, or St. Patrick, a Scottish saint that they have for Ireland. But St. Patrick. But obviously they take the local saints and they make them the patron saints. But not Scotland. We have St. Andrew. Now this is... it's interesting, not only have we chosen an apostle, but we seem to have chosen an apostle who has no real association with Scotland at all. In fact, if you look at where Andrew is the patron saint, you're going to discover, and this won't surprise you if you were here last week, where I talked about the influence of the East and looking to Eastern Christianity, we discover that Andrew is the patron saint of Russia, Romania, Greece, and Constantinople. And Constantinople was at the center of what they called the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Empire, where Eastern Christianity was practiced. And so Andrew is the patron saint of the East. It's even more vivid if you look at it on a map. Let's go to the map. All the blue areas are where Andrew is the patron saint, where Andrew is venerated. You notice the yellow areas, Western Europe. Andrew really doesn't get a big shout there. And suddenly what we have is we have all this blue in the east, and then this tiny little blue. It's not actually shown in the map because Britain's disappearing. It shows our significance. In Scotland, this tiny wee blurb of blue having Andrew. It's a fascinating question to ask. Now, last week I began to point out that the period we're considering, which is 700 to 1100, that there were various options as the Pictish people became Christians. Let's go to the next map. The Picts were occupied everything north of where we are, all the way up to the Orkneys and the Shetlands, all the way out to the Outer Hebrides. And there was a little area of what we call Argyll, Western Scotland, that was occupied by a group called the Scots, or the Gaels. We now call them, can we go back to that slide, the Gaels. They were Irish, just to confuse us. And then south of us, there were two groups. There was a group called the Britons, who occupied Clydesdale and Dumbartonshire, and another group called the Anglo-Saxons, or the English. And the Britons were the Welsh, and they eventually all got dispelled. And the Angles, well, the Anglo-Saxons, they became the English. And they occupied all the way up to almost Stirling, actually, at the time. And at this time in Scottish history, it wasn't even such a thing as Scottish history, it looked like the Anglo-Saxons were about to wipe the board. And there was a big battle up in Forfar where the Picts managed to resist and defeat the Anglo-Saxons. It was the first time that they managed to do that. And it meant that the Anglo-Saxons were not going to go north of the Forth Clyde divide. And it pushed them back to that line of southern Scotland. But it also generated a period where the Picty people began to come together. And for the first time in hundreds of years, became receptive as a group, as a nation, to Christianity. Christianity had been around in southern Scotland and in western Scotland and obviously in Ireland for hundreds of years, but the Picts had proved strangely impervious to it during that time, although there were various Christian missions to the Picts, but they had resisted it. And suddenly at this point, the Pictish nations, so everything north of here, start to embrace Christianity. Now, they had a choice because there was a conflict going on. The Anglo-Saxons, the English, prescribed a form of Roman Catholicism that had come direct from the Pope. In fact, the Anglo-Saxons, the English, had a very close tie to Rome, and they had been founded by a special mission that the Pope had started under a guy called Augustine, who had sent to a place called Canterbury in England and started this mission. So they had a close tie to Rome and Roman Catholicism, whereas the Irish and their Christianity was called Celtic Christianity. And although it had originated out of Roman expressions of the church, it was much more distant and it didn't have a close relationship. And these two groups were in conflict. And this conflict had spilled over a council in Whitby down south, where they were fighting over the way you cut your hair and the date of Easter. It's good to see that we have fights that are about important things in the Christian church. And basically what happened was the Roman Catholic view won out. And the Celtic church and their views and their approach began to go out of fashion. And so the Picts at this moment had the opportunity to embrace one of these versions of Christianity. Were they going to go with the Celtic version and the Irish version, which was more akin to them culturally, or were they going to go with the Anglo-Saxons? And it was at this moment that I suggested last week that a third group appeared, and this group were called the Chaldeans. Okay. Now, there are various versions in church history, Scottish church history, about who the Chaldeans are. Historical orthodoxy would suggest that they were just a form of the Celtic church. I don't believe that, but and what I suggested last week was that the Chaldeans actually were a bunch of Syrian refugees who brought Christianity to the Pictish people. You can see why it's called an alternative Scottish church history. And if you want to hear more about that, you can listen to that. But the reality was that the Chaldeans began to bring Christianity to Clackmannanshire, to Stirlingshire, and all the way up into Fife. And they did that from about 700 to about 730. Meanwhile, the rest of the Picts weren't terribly sure which way they were going to jump in terms of Christianity. And there were four kings who kind of worked this out and worked out what the form of Christianity was going to be. These are the only four kings that you really need to know Pictish history. One is called Brud, and the second one is called Nathan. The third one is called Angus or Ungus, And the fourth one is called Constantine. By the way, the clue towards the east is in the name Constantine. Okay, what happened? We were calling them Angus and Brood and Nathan, and suddenly we've got Constantine? Might be a suggestion of what was happening in Scottish church history, that they were going east rather than west towards Celtic Christianity. But anyway, these kings, and the kings Brood and Nathan were brought up in a Christian home. They probably had a Celtic mother who may have been a Christian, and certainly they were influenced. And they began to open the nation, the Pictish nation, to Christianity. But Nathan wasn't really sure what to do. And so Nathan thought, rather than fighting with the Anglo-Saxons all the time, it was a good idea to take the same Christianity that they had. And so in 717, Nathan kicked out all the Celtic missionaries, so anything that was Irish, he kicked out of Scotland, northern Scotland, and the Pictish lands, and he wrote down south to the Anglo-Saxon church, down near Newcastle, and he wrote to them and he said, is it possible, could you send us up some missionaries and some people to show us what a true worship of Christianity should look like and to build some churches? And they went up, and they went all the way up to the northeast, and they built a church to St. Peter. And so Nathan was making consolidation and building a strong relationship with the Anglo-Saxons. However, something went wrong. Maybe he was seen as a bit wimpy by the rest of the Picts. But anyway, he was deposed, sent to Ireland. And when he came back, he founded a Celtic monastery in Abernethy. All right, no idea why or what happened. But what his successor did was he was no way going to go with Anglo-Saxon Christianity. And he was a man called Angus. And Angus was probably the greatest of the Pictish kings. And he reigned for over 30 years. And he really formed the foundation for the nation of Scotland. Because Angus was the first Pict who began to invade into Clydesdale. He actually conquered the Scots in the west. And he actually even went as far as to invade Ireland, which is something that no Pict had actually done previously. And more than that, he started a long line of fights with the English and the Anglo-Saxons. And just as Angus was coming to this prominence and beginning to expand the Pictish muscle in the area, something happened. He came into the possession of the relics of St. Andrew. Now, the story goes, let's go to the next slide. The story goes that a monk was in Constantinople and he had a vision. He was called St. Rule or St. Regulus, which means rule. Remember last week I was saying in the East, they have the monks don't have a rule, so it isn't like when you join, you get a set of instructions where you have to tick the box. So you have to be celibate, you have to do poverty, you have to do and then you're a proper monk. In the East, they never have things like that. In the East, what happened was you had to pick an example of a godly individual, preferably Jesus, but another saint would do as well. And then you aspire to live like that example. So there was no rule. Your life became the rule. Your life became the example, the outworking of your faith. And so this guy is actually called Rule and expressing that Eastern idea. And it said that he came and he brought the relics of St. Andrews from Constantinople via Greece, and he got shipwrecked in the town that is now called St. Andrews. And he found Angus, and he gave him the relics of St. Andrews. That's one version. That's the official version. That's the one that the tourist department will give you in St. Andrews if you go there. Truth is that maybe an Anglo-Saxon bishop in Hexham, who'd been on a wee trip to Rome and had brought back some relics of St. Andrews, got disillusioned with the Anglo-Saxon church, we're not sure what, but he got deposed by his congregation, and he took a trip north, found Angus, and handed over the relics to him. Not as romantic, but anyway. But whatever it came about, Angus got the relics of St. Andrews. Now, we don't know if it was the coming of the relics, or if it was the Chaldeans, or what it was, but Angus didn't look any longer to the Christianity of the Anglo-Saxons or to the Christianity of the Celts. Angus went wholesale for the Christianity of Byzantium, for the Christianity of the East. Now, I was talking to a historian last week, and he was saying this was a little speculative based on fairly thin sources, which is a fair synopsis of my views last week. However, I do want to present a very powerful piece of evidence that shows the influence of the East and the Byzantine world on Christianity at this time, because this is the tomb, probably, of Angus, son of Fergus, this great Pictish king. Now, the first thing that you will notice about it is a sarcophagus, okay? Now, Scottish Pictish kings didn't use sarcophagi, all right? You know, you've all seen the Viking funerals, you've seen all the burial mounds and the standing stones and all this. They just didn't go for this sort of thing. This is how you got buried in the East, in the Byzantine world, in the Roman, late Roman world. And you'll know if you ever visit any museums in Greece or Constantinople or Turkey, that they're full of these magnificent carved sarcophagus. And here we have one in St. Andrews. But this is Pictish, and it's the earliest form of Pictish art. You know, sometimes when you go up to visit these Pictish museums, they say the Picts are really mysterious, and we have these floating stones, and they're all carved. And all. Actually, the earliest piece is this ginormous sarcophagus in St. Andrews. And it's really interesting if you look at it. Let's go to it. it seems probably based on David, and on the far right, as I look at it, yes, you look at it as well, you have the figure of Angus, and Angus is tearing apart the jaws of a lion. And then in the middle, you see probably Angus again being ambushed by a lion and killing it with his sword as he's riding. And then down lower, we probably see Angus, or maybe Angus' son, out hunting. And we see a scene, and it's very, very reminiscent of the scenes that you will see in the Byzantine world. Let's go to the next slide. Of the great sarcophagi off the East. So whoever was doing this, they had seen sarcophagi, and they knew what they looked like, and they were bringing all the ideas of the East into the northeast of Scotland. Let's continue to the next slide. But most interestingly of all is the way that Angus decides to portray himself. Angus is dressed in a very distinctive way. And it's on the far right of the sarcophagi. And he's not dressed like a Pictish guy. Okay, Picts didn't look like this. They had weird mustaches and amazing hair and looked kind of gruff. He is dressed in the clothing of late Roman antiquity. He's dressed like a Byzantine emperor. And not only is he dressed like a Byzantine emperor, but actually, up on his top right-hand side, there's a lapel brooch. You know those Scottish brooches that you get on your kilts and all that? You look at, hey, I'm Scottish. Well, actually, it comes directly out of the courts of the Byzantine Empire. And it was worn by an emperor called Justinian, the greatest Byzantine emperor. And Angus has self-styled himself with the brooch of Justinian and the clothing of a Byzantine emperor while acknowledging St. Andrews. You've got to understand, this is right at the heart of Pictish world. Here he is. He's modeling himself. Let's go to the next slide. He's modeling himself on the world of Byzantium. Not only that, and of course his son is called Constantine, so we're really getting the message that he's modeling himself on this. Not only is he modeling himself on this, he's also bringing and introducing the cross and the distinctive Christianity of Byzantine Christianity. At the end, you'll see the basis, and you know Celtic crosses? I hate to do this. I feel like I'm spoiling Christmas. Celtic crosses. Well, actually, they're nothing to do with St. Patrick or Sun or anything to do with that. They're actually to do with Byzantium and the symbol of imperial Byzantine power. And here we have the symbol. This is called a Greek cross. It means that all the arms are the same length. And in between it, at the end of the sarcophagi, and in between it, you actually have various symbols. These symbols you will often find on Greek crosses. They normally denote Jesus Christ victor. Right? It's the idea of imperial power reflected in Jesus. Let's go to the next one. And you see, this became the basis of what went on to be your Celtic crosses. Let's go to the next slide. And here it is here. This is the symbol of Byzantine emperors. And so here we have a Pictish ruler, a Pictish king who's dressing himself as a Byzantine emperor. He's wearing Byzantine imperial jewelry. He is bringing Byzantine crosses that reflect the presence of Byzantine imperial power, and he's doing it all at the heart of St. Andrew's and Scotland. And the patron saint is Andrew. Let's go to the next slide. So Angus probably brought the relics of St. Andrew's and all this regalia and all this influence of the East to found the abbey there in St. Andrew's at 747. Again, it probably was founded by a guy called Rule or Regulus. If he was a Chaldean, he may have been brought up in the tradition of the East. He may actually have come from the East because the Chaldeans may have had links with the East. Certainly somebody from the East was coming to do all this sculpture and design all these crosses and bringing all these ideas. The relics themselves involved Andrew's arm, kneecap, three fingers, and a tooth. And so those were the relics. Unfortunately, during the Reformation, John Knox destroyed them all. But if you do want to see the relics of St. Andrew's, you can actually go to Edinburgh and St. Mary's Cathedral there, just beside John Lewis's. The Pope in 1964 took some of Andrew's relics from Greece and brought them to Scotland and gave them as a gift. So you actually can see some of the relics of Andrew there. Let's go to the next slide. Angus, influenced by the East and with this new imperial molding of Pictish kingship and religion, he began to plant churches, and they planted them all up the East Coast, and we have a succession of Chaldean monasteries at places like Abernethy, Scoon, Monifieth, Brechin, and so forth, for Troes, Dornoch, right up into Caithness, right up into Orkney, right up into the Shetland. And Chaldean monasteries were established, and Chaldean Christianity was established throughout, as the Picts began to turn to Christianity. Let's go to the next slide. But this spreading of Christianity through the Picts land while Angus was becoming more powerful was very useful to Angus, particularly in his fight with the Anglo-Saxons. You see, Andrew is famous, and David's going to talk about Andrew next week. Andrew is famous in the Bible. We don't know that much about him. But what we do know is that he brought his brother, Peter, to Jesus. Anglo-Saxon, Roman Catholic Christianity. Who's their key figure? Peter. Byzantine, Scottish Christianity. Who's our key figure? Andrew. Who has preeminence over Peter? Because he was the Christian first and he brought Peter to Jesus. Therefore, Andrew is superior to Peter. It's very useful if you're going to war with a group of people and their patron saint is Peter and your patron saint is Andrew, if your patron saint is seen to be better than the one that you're fighting against. Let's go to the next slide. This was very useful for Angus because Angus, when he, as I said, Angus was the first person to begin to make inroads again into the territories that the Anglo-Saxons had captured. And as the Anglo-Saxons began to move up north, is that coming up okay? Angus led the Pictish armies down into East Lothian to confront an Anglo-Saxon army down there. And we're told this story, that on the night that he was down there, before a great battle against the Anglo-Saxons, he saw in the sky a cross. Let's go and see it. Now, I was down playing golf on Friday at Gullen, which is in East Lothian, not far from this spot. And actually, I wish I'd had my camera phone with me. But in the sky over Gullen, because you get very distinctive cloud formations over there, there was a great big cross, just like the clouds. And this symbol and this sign was a sign that Angus took that God was with them. And this was Andrew's cross. And Andrew was going to help them defeat the Anglo-Saxons who acknowledged Peter. It went on, of course. Let's go on to the next slide. To become the flag of Scotland, and it became the St. Andrew's flag. It's interesting that the story that is told in relation to that is exactly the story that Constantine, the first Byzantine emperor, tells about how he became a Christian. He was about to have a big battle to take the city of Rome, and that night he has a vision, and he's told to put the chiro, that symbol in top right, onto the shields of his warriors, and with that sign he goes and conquers the enemy in Rome. Exactly the same story. Let's continue. Interestingly as well, and here's sometimes how traditions go. Believe it or not, until Angus saw this sign in the heavens of the cross, nobody thought Andrew was crucified on a cross, on an X. There is no tradition prior to this. So Angus says, that's St. Andrew's cross. And because Angus said that was St. Andrew's cross, that became the cross of St. Andrew's. And actually, the tradition that Andrew died on an X cross went from Angus's vision, not from history itself. And it became the foundation. And so all over the world now, Andrew is denoted as having been crucified on an X cross. Let's go to the next slide. So, that's some of the background. Sorry if I've upset you in terms of Scotland and our Celtic ancestry and past. What do we learn from all this? What do we learn from this fascinating period? And it actually was the period that provided the foundation for the nation of Scotland. It gave us our flag. It gave us our patron saint. And the spread of Christianity actually provided the basis for the unifying of the different territories like Clydesdale and Ireland and the west of Scotland. And the Picts. First of all, I think we see three things here. First of all, we learn about religious exclusivity. How Christianity can be used, and how sometimes we can begin to hold the truth in a way that makes us think that we are superior to others. You see, the cult of Andrew that Angus introduced wasn't ultimately about the sermon of the Good Samaritan or the story of the Good Samaritan. It was all about, we are superior to you. Our faith is superior to yours. Our Christianity is more primitive than yours. And using these claims of exclusivity to actually provide the basis for bashing other people. At this juncture, what began to happen in Pictish society was the ancient stones and stones that had been part of Pictish society for millennium began to be carved. And they began to be carved with various imagery. And let's go to the next slide. And one of the most famous of these is found near Forfar. And on the front, you'll actually see a Celtic cross. Do you see the Greek cross at the top? The four complete, and then they extended a little bit, and then they made four holes, and this is on our way to your Celtic cross, by the way. You can see its evolution there. But on the other side of it, what's portrayed? The portrayal of the battle near Forfar where we defeated the Anglo-Saxons. You see, Christianity becomes a sign by which we conquer and we suppress those who disagree with us. This was actually the foundation of a lot of what we were doing in terms of Christianity. And again, whenever Christianity gets like this, and I teach this in college, whenever we combine faith with politics in a way that our faith becomes the servant of politics and actually is employed in a political way to oppress others, we need to question what we're doing in terms of our faith. That leads us, can we go back? That leads us to our second issue, which is the whole idea of self-serving biblical interpretation. You know, St. Andrew's cross wasn't there in the Bible, and it wasn't even there in Christian tradition. Angus created that notion because it served his political ends of mainly defeating the Anglo-Saxons. And often we do the same thing in terms of our self-serving biblical interpretation. Rather than allowing the Bible to shape us, what we do is we create things that we want it to say and do. And so we make it self-serving. One of the things that I always say about the way that we read the Bible, if you are reading the Bible and you are not finding yourself being called to change, you're probably not interpreting the Bible right. The Bible should be standing over and against. It should be challenging us. It should be calling for change. You see that in the story of Amos, the prophet, who speaks to the kings. Amos and the prophets did not go around affirming the kings of Israel and what they were doing. The prophets spoke and they challenged what was the status quo. They challenged what was occurring and called for change. And I believe if we have a faith that somehow builds exclusivity and power claims, and if we have a faith that is not calling us to change, then actually I think we're moving towards a distorted kind of faith. The third thing that we learn is that the Bible can shape a culture. Now, although I've said a couple of negative things about the formation of Scottish Christianity, one of the amazing things about Scottish Christianity is that you see the Bible beginning to shape the landscape of this Pictish world. And it began to shape it in all kinds of ways. Let's move to the next slides. It began to shape the idea of kingship. And we see this in the story of Angus's son, Constantine, or grandson. Constantine, and if you go to the Duplin Cross in Dunning, you'll see it's a wonderful piece of Pictish art, roughly from about the same period. And you'll actually see portrayals of King David. And it's believed that actually the Pictish people and Celtic people didn't actually have an idea of kingship until they started to read the Bible and the Old Testament in particular, and then they got this idea of kingship. They also got the idea of nationhood from there, but that was a little later on. And they got this image, an idea of David, and they saw that David was both a musician and a poet and also a warrior. And the idea began to be that a good king would be both a philosopher, both a poet, maybe a musician, but also a warrior. And some of you will recognize these characteristics in Scots. There was an incident recently in Parliament involving some of our SNP MPs, and they ended up in a series of illicit relationships. And the SNP members of Parliament were described as romantic revolutionaries and the mujahideen of this Parliament, and by this young lady. And I thought that's quite interesting. I said it was good to see that Scottish guys' stock was rising in the press at that time, point in time. But this idea of Scots as warriors and lovers and is something that makes up Scottish ideas. But it came from the Bible beginning to shape the idea of kingship. The idea of justice and good rule was coming from the Bible. But more than this, it also we begin to see in Constantine's reign, we begin to see a different kind of Christianity. See, the Duplin Cross, if you go and see the Duplin Cross, you'll actually see not just Byzantine influences, not just the cult of St. Andrews, you'll actually see the Duplin Cross embracing all kinds of cultural influences. You'll see Anglo-Saxon influences there, English influences in this cross. You'll see Irish influences in the shape and the design of the cross. You will see Byzantine influences. Some believe you'll even see Egyptian influences in some of the stuff. But here you have something, and remember I told you last week, Dunning became the center of the Scottish church for a few years during the reign of Constantine. And there you will see a new vision of the nation, a vision of a nation which is not bound by some kind of exclusivity, not bound by a desire to exclude and remove, but actually a desire to integrate and to bring together under Jesus Christ and his Lordship. You see, the story of the Good Samaritan that Jesus provides us is actually a story about how we should relate to those who are different. And remember I told you before a few weeks ago that at the heart of the Christianity and the heart of Jesus' vision was the idea that Christianity and faith is not about external things. It's not about how you wash your hands. It's not about ceremonial laws. It's actually about what happens in your heart. And the heart of an Anglo-Saxon, the heart of a Pict, the heart of an Irish monk, the heart of a Welsh-speaking Briton is the same. The heart of a Jew and a Gentile is the same. The heart of a black man in Southern America and the heart of a policeman in the USA is the same. You see, the vision of Jesus was of an egalitarian faith which denoted people by what God does in their heart, not by their nationality, not by claims to superiority based either on race, tradition, or color, but a sense of a lordship which treated all people as equal before that God. One of the interesting things that happened at this time, and I was reading it this week, was that in 697, just as this was all starting, Brude, that first of the Pictish kings that I mentioned, he signed, along with another churchman in Scotland, a declaration that was being ushered by the Celtic Church. And it was basically a declaration about the equality of women. And quite a remarkable document. It's called the Declaration of Innocence. You should read it. And it was basically saying, guys, in our society, everyone, especially women and children, need to be acknowledged as equals. Powerful force. And I believe that the Bible can still shape a 21st century world just as it shaped an 8th century world. Our world is no more hostile to Christianity than the world of the Picts. But Scripture can still shape these things. And in a world where racism is on the rise, in a world where divisions are occurring exponentially and we switch on our news, in a world where people have uncertainty about nationhood and identity, it is time that we return to the Scriptures and call people back to the Bible and the message of Christ as we move into our future. Let's pray together. Lord Jesus, we thank you for our past. We thank you for the examples, for the good things and the bad things in that past. But Lord, most of all, we thank you for the way in which your word shaped our society, for the way in which it shaped our history. And Lord, we pray that as we go into our future, that it will be your word that will not only shape our past, but it will again shape our future. Lord, give us a zealousness and a zeal like those who went before us to bring your word to others, to see our nation again brought to a place of faith, to a place where our world is shaped by biblical values and ideals. Lord, I pray for the transformation of our land. I ask this in your name. Amen.